appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming, and I know that if we had had a conversation, I think, on governance maybe a year ago, or maybe when I was supposed to be here in April, everybody might have been deeply tuned into this, because it was talked about everywhere, with companies falling left and right, and the threat to the financial system worldwide being fairly evident. August, I found this year, a lot of people took very long vacations. It's the first time people in over a year were able to take vacations, and I think maybe some of this governance stuff is getting to be stuff people are tired of hearing about. But you're here tonight, I appreciate your coming, and maybe I'll give you a secret and share something with you that you can take back to your office and make some extra money yourselves, make some extra money for your firm. Just don't tell anybody who didn't come, okay? That's the deal. In any case, and coming back to why we're focused on this, Graham had mentioned my involvement with Permia. Prior to being part of Permia, Prior to being part of Permia, I had built three different risk management departments. The last one being at U.S. Bancorp's Piper Jaffray broker-dealer subsidiary. And the emphasis that I'd always had in risk management was on how it adds value to the corporation. How is it that you use it to take the risks that your company wants to take, but do so in a better way? There's a lot of emphasis in risk management on loss, a lot of emphasis in risk management on control, and those are elements to being able to chase value and create the most value. But if that's where you stop and if that's where your focus is in terms of risk management, you've left a good deal on the table in terms of the potential of what you can deliver and the value that you'll become to your companies. I think when risk management and now governance, as we focus on that as well, we want to know how it adds value. Is there any evidence that it adds value? Do these things intersect in any way? And why was there this loss of name firms like Bear and Lehman and pretty nearly AIG, GE, you know, a company people were thinking of as AAA credits? These companies suffered greatly during this crisis. And why? Does it say anything about their governance structures? Does it say anything about their risk management? This is a follow-up to a conversation that we had, or presentation I had back here a little over a year ago, I guess about almost a year and a half ago now, in looking at ways that we can think about this resiliency and the ways in which we can think about risk management that's a little bit different. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. I know that presentation is online. But things that we'll talk about today include a little bit of a return to the focus on resilience, a touch on some of the impacts of psychology and complexity in governance and risk management, and then this notion of adaptive systems. So those of you who aren't familiar with the science of complexity, this is an emerging area. I'm far from an expert in this, but I find it incredibly fascinating in terms of filling the gaps that I saw when I was learning in graduate school about the efficient markets and finance and economics that didn't seem to work well in practice. And I think the field of complexity in Santa Fe Institute is contributing tremendously to this understanding of why finance might be a little bit different than what we have been modeling it to be in these last 20 years or so. So quickly, if I could give you a few definitions to distinguish the way in which I think about risk management and governance. Risk, as I said, a lot of people focus on it on the negative side. Risk really is a two-sided coin, in that it's also positive. I like to think, again, of value and this notion of what something is worth. That's its value. Value is not always monetary, but it is in many cases when we think about it, our companies. Risk is that we don't know what our value is going to be at some point in the future. We have some sense of what our value or the value of something is today. But tomorrow, 5 minutes from now, a year from now, what we don't know is what that value will be, and that's what risk is. That change is driven by a risk event, and risk management is altering the way in which that risk event impacts us into trying to be more in a way that we want it to be. So you might transfer risk, you might accept certain risks, you might go out and hedge things. That's your way of reshaping the way in which these risk events change the impact of a risk event on you. And then governance is really a framework within which risk management operates. In fact, the framework within which the whole corporation operates. And when we talk about a framework of governance, there are typically two ways in which people will talk about it. The legal framework, and that's regulations, rules, court cases, case law, and how the law or how listing requirements at various exchanges dictate certain things you have to have in place in your companies. This duty of care and duty of loyalty, for those of you who are familiar with responsibilities that boards are typically expected to have, or board members are typically expected to have, the duty of care and duty of loyalty are the two most commonly cited. Duty of loyalty meaning that the work that you're doing for those boards and for that company is where your focus is. You're not doing it and doing other work that might be of damage to the company or taking advantage of your position with the company. And the duty of care is knowing what you're doing, making sure you understand what the company is doing, making sure you have a good sense for the risks and the objectives that the company is pursuing. I'll get into that a little bit more in the presentation. The operational framework is really where risk management comes in. This is how the business is pursuing its objectives, the rules that set out for pursuing these objectives, how decisions are made, and how information is validated. The defense that a board member has when things go wrong is that they've really put in place an operational framework that helped them fulfill their duty of care. They used prudent business decisions. They had good information. They made sure they had the resources in place. Sometimes things don't work out. Sometimes you make bad business decisions. So the operational framework of governance is how the company's working. But it's got an objective, too. Our objective, again, getting back to this notion of value, our objective in governance is to maximize value. Value in quotations is something that is determined by your board. If you're a nonprofit, it's a little bit harder to determine your value in a financial sense. You can do it. There's actually a way to do it. But for the most part, value is something that conveys why the corporation exists, why the organization exists. And you'd like to maximize today's value with all the decisions that you're making. Your resources, which are scarce, particularly this notion of risk capital, which I'm sure many of you in the room are familiar with, it's that effective use of these scarce resources where enterprise risk management and risk management in general have the biggest role in governance. So how do we use those resources in a way of pursuing that value? And then allowing people who take risk and innovate to have enough resources to do so in a way that's responsible. And ultimately, this comes back to giving the board its satisfaction that it's fulfilling its duty of care. Now, that's internal. Externally, governance has this role of providing stakeholders, shareholders, creditors, liquidity providers, whoever it might be, people outside the corporation, a sense that they should have confidence in the company, a sense that they should have confidence in the organization, that it's going to be around, that it's doing good things, that it's worthwhile being a part of. There was a breakthrough in research about, I guess that's now about 6 years ago, that stimulated and is rapidly growing area of research around the association of governance and value, if there's any evidence that governance creates value within organizations. The theory should say that a company that's well governed should be worth more or should do better. But there really hadn't been a whole lot of testing of this out there until this paper from Gompers, Ishii, and Metrick came out in response to a lot of the takeovers that had taken place in the 1990s. They looked at whether protection against shareholder actions, so removing the ability of the owners of the company to take action that would stop the board of directors from doing something, whether that had a negative impact on value, or whether giving lots of shareholder control, direct control by the shareholders, increased the value of companies. So they put these groups into two different categories: a democracy portfolio, which is where the shareholders had lots of control, and a dictatorship portfolio where there would be things like poison pill protections and other things that made it difficult for somebody to take over a company. What they found was there were substantially higher annualized returns, somewhere around 9%. They didn't claim that this was something that was causation. They couldn't necessarily say that the governance caused this excess return, but they found a correlation. And they used these 24 factors that came from the Investor Responsibility Research Center. And again, they're all pretty much about whether shareholders have control of the organization. Looking further now at this external governance and internal governance, which is where the board and the executive function play a role, Kramers and Nair, a couple years after that, found somewhat similar returns. So firms that had the highest level of vulnerability to takeover, meaning again, there was a lot of shareholder power in those organizations, were bought, and then you shorted the ones that had a lot of protections. So they found excess returns. This stimulated a whole bunch of research And it continues today in looking at whether there's any value that's being created. So and typically what we're seeing in these kinds of research is that, and the factors that people are looking at are those dictatorship and democracy external factors that I had just mentioned. And then a follow-up study that was done a couple years after that took those 24 factors that Gomperzici and Metrick had and said, really there are only six of them that matter. And those six are staggered boards. For those of you who maybe don't know what a staggered board does in terms of its influence on change at a company, if you have directors elected, say, every year or two, or a third of the board every year or every 2 years, you can't change the board quickly. So that's a protection against change. So if you can elect a whole board in 1 year, you can change a company with one vote. Limits the ability for owners to amend the bylaws, poison pills, golden parachutes, those things are up there. You can look at this another time. And then governance factors. Graham, did you have a question?
Sorry. So what is the direction of causation? The staggered boards?
No one yet is saying there's causation. These are all correlation issues. Okay. They're saying contemporaneously they find that there's excess value measured through a Tobin's Q on these companies that's contemporaneous and associated with well-governed companies, based on this notion that governance is defined by shareholder control.
So if you have a staggered board, it means you can't change the company.
That would be a negative. Yep.
So that would be a negative?
Correct. Correct. Yep. Because if somebody wanted to take over the company, in theory they should be paying a premium and you can realize excess returns. If they can't take over the board, they're not going to be able to take over the company. They can't change the company, or say an activist shareholder wants to change the company, pensions particularly. So again, those are looking at whether it's just shareholder control. There are also people who've looked at these governance factors that are more tick box things. So have there been things like a change in an auditor recently? That might indicate a problem in a company. Has there been officer turnover? There have been a lot of director turnovers, insider trading, buying and selling. Those are other factors that go into some of these. And I'm sorry, this one didn't come across here well. But forensic accounting is looking again at the internal practices. Are companies living the governance that they claim they have or that the structure they have should create? So are there funny things going on with the accounting that might have been associated with fraud, SEC actions or regulatory actions, shareholder litigation, earnings restatements, for example? So this is where we see a lot of the work being done in terms of analyzing. So again, to reemphasize, the studies have shown correlation but not causation. But can we come up with some reasonable theory about why there would be causation? I mean, if so, we might have a little more comfort in the notion that this is a causation and it's not some other factor like market capitalization or excess risk that's causing these unknown returns. So for those of you who, well, I don't think these came across too well, I'm sorry, I think maybe in the conversion a couple of these things got covered up, so I apologize for that. But the equation here that we're looking at is very simple, and it's driven by, I think the background that I've had mostly in a fixed income world, is that in the fixed income world, we're always looking at uncertain cash flows, particularly in mortgages where I spent a lot of my career. Modeling the uncertainty of future cash flows is critical to understanding what the value of any mortgage security is. They're a lot of fun, but to model. They're not always fun to own, as I think people will tell you in the last couple of years. But you can use this too to evaluate the value of any asset. You know, you can use this to value a company. So a company, if you're an owner of a company, you're owner of an organization, that company is going to return cash flows to you, these fees, over various periods. And this obviously is some sort of an annual function. And then those cash flows go for some period of time that's uncertain. Their amount is uncertain. And then we adjust for that uncertainty through this discounting factor, with this being a risk-free rate and this being some sort of risk premium that can vary over time. Okay, very simple equation, but this is the element, this is where I think that you can demonstrate that risk management and governance, as we practice them, can create value, and why I do believe it's causality and not just correlation. Theory being good governance helps people make better decisions. Okay, I can say that to you all day long. You don't have to believe me. There are lots of reasons to think why that makes sense, but there's actually some evidence out there that the market believes it too. Companies that hold cash, in this study by Dittmer and Mark Smith, I think I'm pronouncing that last name correctly, the value of cash holdings at companies that had these Gomperzici metric kinds of characteristics of shareholder control, the value of cash was nearly double the value of cash at companies that would have fallen into the poorly governed categories. Now, the statement that the market seems to be making in that is that they expect the well-governed companies to put that cash to better use. It's worth more than a dollar at well-governed companies. A dollar of cash is worth somewhere around $1.40 on average, I think, at a well-governed company. At a poorly governed company, it's worth on average something around 60 cents. So they expect poorly governed companies to destroy value with that cash and well-governed companies to create value. That's some pretty strong evidence that the market thinks there's something different here about these companies. I mentioned at the beginning what I talked about last April was this concept of resiliency and ductility. Is there any sense that well-governed companies should generate better cash flows for a longer period of time? You care about that too. I mean, eventually the discounting becomes so great that it doesn't matter, but you care for a substantial period of time about when companies are going to return cash to you. It's the same kind of question that somebody on a credit side would ask. You know, are you going to be there to pay this bond off? I care whether the company's still going to be around. So this particular paper looked at whether there was an association of governance as measured by Standard & Poor's new, relatively new, analysis of governance at companies and their credit ratings. And what it found is that generally, good governance is associated with better credit rating. There are a couple of strange exceptions to this in their paper, which they point out as the conflict between shareholders and equity investors and bond investors. Because sometimes there's a tension where the equity investors would do something that would benefit them that wouldn't necessarily benefit the bondholders. That's where they find some exceptions. But generally what they find is that well-governed companies are better credits. That suggests that well-governed companies have better resiliency. Now, why might that be? If you're modeling credit, please forgive that this looks like a normal curve. It was easier to draw a normal curve than to do something that looks more like a credit spectrum. Risk management is done well in a couple of different places. It's done well here in the middle of this. If this curve is meant to show distribution of future values, today's value is right here in the middle, and this is a distribution of future values. This is kind of trying to show what risk is. Risk management's really good at managing small changes in value, hedging, whatever it might be, hedging foreign exchange or bond prices or equity prices. We do a reasonable job out here of managing or of measuring the potential for large losses. So this is where capital is being calculated, what kind of capital you should hold is being calculated, credit ratings are being calculated based on this. We don't do as good a job as most people put forward, but we do a reasonably good job of understanding those tails. But somewhere where risk management has, I think, failed because it hasn't really paid enough attention to it, is what happens between the middle and the tail. Lehman Brothers and Bear and a couple other companies went out of business well before their losses exceeded their capital. They lost their customers, they lost their liquidity providers, regulatory intervention. All sorts of things can happen here where a tipping point has been reached that puts your company out of business or severely impairs its ability to do business well before you reach this kind of loss. So this is where governance and enterprise risk management can have an influence. I've shown this slide here before, so if you've seen it, please forgive me, but I'll explain it here just quickly. This is meant to illustrate the emergence of problems within a company. So this is the negative side of risk. This is the loss side that we're focused on. It's meant to show that every problem takes time to develop. So these are supposed to be periods of time. Each one of these lines is supposed to represent some kind of a loss emerging. It might be a $100 loss, it might be a $100 billion loss. It doesn't matter. It just shows you that over time they develop, some take longer than others, and they will all unchecked reach 100% of their potential loss. In a company that has a good risk management structure and a good governance structure, there are elements in place that intercept these losses as they're developing. Whether you've got a problem response team that intervenes or people are risk aware, you have a good risk management team, these problems are stopped before they reach that full potential. And what happens if that's the case is that you actually change the distribution of future outcomes. You actually shift this distribution to the right, making it more valuable, and you reduce the tail on this. So the ultimate impact is that you have a better credit. So it's somewhat consistent with the results that came out of that one paper. And then finally, I think, and probably most underappreciated in terms of the impact that governance and risk management can have on the value of a company or the value of some asset, is its influence on perceived risk. Okay, in psychology, in some of the behavioral finance, there is more of an emphasis now in looking at how people respond to risk, how they perceive risk, how it influences the choices that they make. So in the work Kahneman and Tversky have done, they look at this creation or change in the way in which people value something when loss becomes a possibility, or when there's a change in state of something. If you don't think you can lose money on something, and then all of a sudden you discover you can, you have a fairly radical reaction to that. If you live in a place that you don't think can have an earthquake, and it does, you change your feeling about where you live. Because it's a new state. It's almost like a binary 0-1 that you thought was 0 and all of a sudden became 1. That influences how you feel about risk going forward. The other thing is this notion of loss avoidance. And loss avoidance is your response to the potential for large losses. If you live in a place that might have an earthquake, but you think they're always going to be minor, it might not bother you that much. But if you know that there's a chance that there might be an 8-2 on the Richter scale, the sense that you have about whether it's good to live in that place is much more dramatically influenced than how lovely it is where you are. Putting it in the sense of a game, if I were to toss a coin and say, I'll give you $1 if it's heads and you give me $1 if it's tails, you might play the game just to entertain me and hope I go on. If I change the game though and say, if it's heads, I'll give you $1 million, if it's tails, you give me $1 million, the studies have shown that you won't play that game, even if you know the coin is fair, even if you know I'm an honest person, unless I'm willing to pay you on the order of about $2.5 million for the $1 million that you're risking. And the reason is that $1 million impact on most people is very large. It influences everything else in your life if you were to lose $1 million. So when a company presents you with a huge amount of risk, the potential for large loss, you'll assign a dramatically higher discount rate to that particular company. Otherwise, if you think it only presents you with the probability of some small losses, you change that. So this risk factor, this discount factor, this risk premia, is influenced greatly by what you perceive as the future possibilities or probabilities that company will give you or will yield a large surprise loss. Particularly relating to the last 2 years, there's some research in Elke Weber. I don't know if you guys know her work at Columbia. She's mostly doing work in psychology. Some of her stuff is touching in the finance space. I hope the finance world discovers her more, because I think her work is of tremendous relevance to us, particularly in areas like option pricing. She's looking at this notion of risk as feelings, one paper on it with these other three authors. But risk as feeling looks again at the emotional way in which we process risk that's happened. So if a risk event happens, the first reaction we typically have is one that's emotional, and it's reactive. It's based on the evolutionary response, the fight or flight, I think is the way I hear some people refer to it. But the possibility that if you don't respond, you could be eaten, somewhere deeply ingrained in us, that seems to be. That's the first reaction. The second reaction takes a longer period of time, and it's more analytical. So it eventually takes you back to a point of rational thinking, but it takes a longer time to get there. So let's take a company, for example, that you might have been analyzing their credit on. The company announces a surprise earnings report that's well below your expectations. The initial reaction, typically in the marketplace, is to sell that company off. But your analysis of that company probably hasn't changed that much. There's something that's new in there. It's a piece of information that's new. But the structure that you've been analyzing up to that point was probably not that much changed. So eventually, if this company, particularly if it's well-governed and well-run, eventually you're going to see the values return to where they were. So in this kind of processing, well-governed companies can actually present you with an opportunity from a trading standpoint if a risk event happens. And that risk event doesn't actually have to happen to that company. If you were a bank that's well-governed last year, probably didn't matter, because all banks were painted with a very broad risk stroke. And then a lot of banks gave opportunities in the marketplace. So we think about a bank. Let's say that's what we're looking at. Let's say this is your own company's internal model of what the future earnings stream is for that bank. Now, these are the C's. These are the cash flows. We're going to say these are the cash flows that are coming back to you. This is what I think is going to be returned to me. Well, most people are pretty smart, and they're not going to go off of just one analyst viewpoint. So go out and collect the data from 8 or 10 analysts. And this is what you find. You find that there's general agreement in these first couple of years. There's not a whole lot of risk in terms of what people think this bank is going to earn over these couple of years. But as we get out in some of the distant years, there's a range now of maybe $1.10 in earnings on all the way up to about $4 in earnings. So this is the introduction of some uncertainty, some risk, and why I have to have some sort of a discount premium, risk premium in discounting the value of the company. Risk managers like to think of the world stochastically. This might be a Monte Carlo simulation of what the bank's potential earnings are in the future. And you'll notice the difference in this now is that in some cases, loss has been introduced. Remember, I talked about how there's this change in framing, a change in mindset, when now loss becomes a possibility. So this kind of simulation, including the fact that in one case earnings look like they might be $10 a share, this kind of analysis now impacts those risk premia, particularly because loss is introduced, but the average of all of these is just the same as that one single estimate that we made originally. And now I've got some risk. This is what I'm perceiving going forward. This is influencing my risk premium. But what happens if this is what I saw? So this is the world of that bank or banks like that bank, and there are lots of these earning streams, but in a few cases, there were dramatic surprise losses that were realized. There is a point at which all investors have that they're not willing to take a risk beyond something. So in this case, if you saw this, you might not invest in this particular company. For a company presenting this kind of picture to the outside, you know that it's increased your cost of raising capital because some people aren't interested in participating in your company. And in this case, for example, it might have been a big surprise from the subprime crisis that knocked this particular bank out or severely impacted that particular bank. A couple more pieces just to point out where there's evidence that there's association and in some cases causation. This study was a working paper done looking at the UK Code of Corporate Governance, where they have this comply or explain methodology requirement. You have to comply with these guidelines or explain why you're not going to. So there's a lot of transparency around it. This research found that there was a very positive link between compliance with this code of governance and firm performance. They also tested to try and eliminate this notion that it was something other than governance. So they believe that they showed causation in their particular paper. And this paper that just came out, more directly relevant to people who are pursuing enterprise risk management, was a study of insurance companies in the United States that had evidence of advanced enterprise risk management programs within their companies, and they found that these companies were trading at a premium of about 16.5% to companies that didn't have that out there. There seems to be a lot of evidence building out there that governance is associated with value. I have not shown you some of the papers that say it's not the case, that there's something endogenous, so don't let me leave you with the belief that this is a universal sense that's out there. There are some people who disagree with this, but it's my sense from my own work, and also I think some of this research is pretty good, that we are seeing evidence that the market is rewarding people for doing running their companies well. Now, when this research is emerging, this looks exciting. It looks like there's undiscovered value that's out there in the marketplace, and present company excluded. That means people are going to try and make money off of it. And so there are these companies now that sell governance ratings. I mean, why have to go to all the effort of getting all this data on your own? You can buy it. You can just buy that data. So ISS was purchased by RiskMetrics. ISS is probably the most famous of these groups, Investor Shareholder Services. They often tell people how you should vote when you're voting your proxies based on governance at companies. The corporate library takes an approach much like rating agencies do in analyzing companies' governance structures, and they'll issue a governance rating. Governance Metrics International looks at companies all over the world, several hundred, I believe, inputs into their metrics to tell you where a company ranks in terms of its governance. Audit Integrity combines governance and accounting forensics. And then this other company, which RiskMetrics also owns, I think it's CFRA Accounting is the name of it, is also something that looks at accounting forensics. People are paying for this stuff, so there must be some value in it. But Stanford University did a research study last year and asked, how good are these things? Guess what? Zip. Almost zip. They found almost nothing that they added in terms of predictive value looking forward at stocks. Audit integrity, GMI, I haven't seen, I'm sure ISS probably has some papers in this area too, have a very different conclusion that they come to. Some substantial claims about excess return that can be gained on a forward-going basis by understanding a company's governance today. So somewhere there's an issue. Now I think, in looking at this particular paper, one of the things they suffered from is the time frame that they chose. In our analysis and looking at the performance of well-governed and poorly governed companies, the period over which they tested this, it looks to us like that was one of those anomalies where poorly governed companies were outperforming well-governed companies for a period of time. So there's a possibility that this study is biased by that. There's another study that came out from Columbia Law, which also seemed to cast doubt on whether these governance metrics provide value for forward-looking investments. Again, I think that there's some issues around samples, where they're chosen, and how companies are chosen and stuff. Because these companies still are selling their products. There are a lot of people that are using them, and I've found some value in them in my own work, so I wouldn't discount them entirely. Let's just take a look at something quick. Last 2 years, very interesting period of time. These are numbers I ran, so I'm not going to try and get you to sign on for one of these companies. I'll just tell you that this data came from one of those commercial vendors. And what I did was to grab the data from companies that are listed on the NYSE, NASDAQ, and Amex. Throughout companies that had a price less than $10, because there's all sorts of weird stuff that happens with companies that trade for a dollar or two, stuff that's probably not very valid for this kind of analysis. And said, at the end of December 2006, show me the top 10% and the bottom 10%. How did they do over this period for the next 2 years? What was the result? No changes in the portfolio. You can't get smart and say, oh gosh, I didn't realize that bank was so poorly governed. I'll take that out of my portfolio. Just blindly, was there any value in this forward-looking knowledge? Well, over that period, the group that was in the top 10% of well-governed companies returned over 14% more than the poorly governed companies, about 7% a year. You remember those other studies were saying it's about 8% annually, 9% annually. There seems to be some settling around these kinds of numbers. And this part, I think, which is really important, is that the companies that were in the poorly governed portfolio had volatility about 20% higher. So the historical volatility, looking back at the price behavior, was substantially higher on this. It looks like these are in a different risk and reward plane over this stressed period of time. So I think some of this is consistent with some of the other research that was done. Something else to point out about this, though, is that in looking at the data, looking at single company analytics on governance really does not look very promising to me. These metrics don't seem to me to have very good predictive power on one company. So if you go out and take the best governed company that's out there and go long that company and take the worst governed company by these metrics and short it, it's a pretty risky bet. In part because there's a lot of noise around how governance works and whether this governance is in place in the way it appears to be from the outside. In part two, poorly governed companies may not be revealed for years. The problems that a poorly governed company like GE, Jack Welch, Six Sigma, how could GE be poorly governed? Well, some of these metrics were showing GE as one of the worst governed companies back in 2000. 2001. That took a long time to show up. AIG, there was some noise in the marketplace around that time, but AIG for a long time was showing up as one of the most poorly governed companies out there. And that took a long time to show up. So if you're trying to short something that the market loves, you may not be around to have it be realized. On the other hand, if you create these portfolios that seem to be taking that whole sample size, the large sample size, I think you get a better sense of what the probabilities are in this. Now, I mentioned the second bullet here, or I want to highlight that second bullet here. This is something I think that's happening in the marketplace maybe right now, but we found it happening in two different cases out in the markets where there seems to be, for lack of a better term, yield chasing in equities. Back in the dot-com bubble, right before the dot-com bubble burst, right before this sell-off in 2007, the poorly governed companies seem to be outperforming the well-governed companies fairly substantially. And the only thing I can think of, this is a sample of two or three, a sample of two times isn't enough to make any conclusion off of, but someone I was talking to about this said, it could be that those were the only companies that hadn't yet rallied. Or it could be that people were so blind, particularly in the dot-com bubble, that they would do anything, invest in anything that came out. And they didn't really care about whether the companies were well-run because the company would IPO at 100 and trade at 400 before the day was over. So there could be some of this yield chasing that's going on, particularly from the pensions, that have to find some way to recover what they lost when the dot-com bust happened in terms of their ability to consider themselves fully funded. And it may be happening right now, because I will say over the last couple of months, the poorly governed companies, maybe the last 4 or 5 months, the poorly governed companies by these portfolio metrics have been doing better than the well-governed companies. Part of that is an unwinding of last year. What did AIG do? AIG quadrupled or something on a short squeeze. There's stuff like that that's happening out there. So let me switch over a little bit from the academic side to say, how is it internally in these operational frameworks that we in our companies might structure ourselves to be well-governed, to take advantage of this external perception of being well-governed that might help us raise capital more effectively and increase value in our organization? These are behavioral descriptions of companies that are typically poorly governed are in this realm of defending value. Companies that are well-governed tend to stay in the realm of creating value. You see things like having to respond to news about your company at poorly governed companies. Well-governed companies tend not to have these surprise news stories that they're always defending themselves over. They tend to have incentives that are properly aligned so that their CEOs are compensated the right way. People in the companies who take risks are compensated in the right way. And people have a lot of loyalty to the company. That's what we typically will see. In the typical governance framework that you see, just broadly speaking, it's very hierarchical. And this chart's intended to demonstrate that hierarchy where equity investors hand off responsibility to the board, who hand off responsibility to the executive leadership, who hand off responsibility to the middle managers, who hand off responsibility to the line employees, who are typically the customer-facing people and the ones originating risk, and the risk managers who also have some interaction with these external parties that can influence the company. Agency risk, that most of you are probably familiar with that term, is that at each one of these points there's an assumption that the handoff that's being done is in a way that the next group will act in the interest of the higher group. But what we know is that the next group will act in their own interest, or they'll act in the interest that they believe is in the interest of the group above them because they're good people. But also in this hierarchical structure, we have huge information loss. At each level that there's information shared, it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 20% of the accuracy of that information is lost. So as you go from where the board is setting the initial policies and objectives and directives of the company down to where the risk is being originated, more than half, typically, of the value of the message has been lost. So you're getting more inaccurate information than accurate information down at this point in this hierarchical structure. And the flow back is the same way. So the board's trying to find out whether they're doing good things for their customers and whether they're meeting the market's demands, and this group can probably give them the best sense of whether that's the case internally, but they've got to go through so many different communication channels to get back up to the top that the information that the board gets from that group is probably inaccurate. There's a gentleman named Shan Turnbull down in Australia who has been talking about this concept of network governance. And network governance is a recognition that there are lots of interactions that people have with internal and external parties. And this chart is intended to show some of those lines of communication. The recognition here in this particular model is that these external parties, if they can provide direct information to the executive leadership and direct information to the board, or if that can come through, I think one of my lines is missing here. Oh no, the customers are, yeah, one of my lines is missing here. There should be a line going from the customer straight to the board. It's up here, I'm sorry. It goes up to the network governance on top. That's a way for the board of directors to get unfiltered information. It's pure information. It's not being filtered by any of the people to whom they've handed off this exposure and the ability to pursue objectives. So I like actually that network model because of some of the checks it gives on a loss of information. But I like to combine it with something called distributive governance. You'll see distributive governance is this notion being that if you press the management of risk as close as you can to the point where risk is being originated, you probably have the most responsive, reactive, and intelligent way of managing problems, particularly as they emerge. A problem can be lack of understanding of where your customers are going. Deepak Jain, who I don't know if he still is, he was the dean of the Kellogg Business School at Northwestern, said to me the biggest risk any company faces is missing where their customers want to be in 2 years' time. So if you miss that in this distributive governance, you're trying to push out the ability to change the product and respond to risks that emerge as close as you can to those risk originators. So you distribute these accountabilities, and you have very short communication lines. So it's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. This might come under something called nested policies. And I'll talk in just a second about what nested policies are and the governance framework that in which those have been developed. Then a check on all of this stuff. This is how you interfere with the law, or how you make sure that there aren't filters being put on the information that's coming to you, that you validate that the information is correct, is an essential part of this network and distributive governance as well. Shan Turnbull, I don't know if he uses the term stakeholder committee or something similar to that, but the engagement of a stakeholder committee is actually people who have an interest in your company who are outside of the company, liquidity providers, creditors, customers, retirees, being a part of the actual governance of your company. In his model, they might even be able to veto board decisions. It's a very somewhat radical concept. And then a board-level chief risk officer, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second, which I don't know anybody who has right now, but I think it's an important way to implement this kind of network distributed governance model. Has anyone in this room ever heard of Carver governance? Alex knows the Carver governance model. Anybody else know the Carver governance model? A couple heads that are nodding. The Carver governance model, I think, is a really interesting one in that it also emphasizes this distribution of accountabilities. There are four things that they say that the board of directors should do, and that's it. Determine the ends of the company. What are the objectives that the company is supposed to be pursuing? What are the rules for pursuing those? What are these executive limitations? What are the rules around which you have, or within which you have to operate? What's the relationship between the board and the company? Is it just the CEO? And then what's our process? What is it? How is it that we're going to be accountable for what we do? In its Carver governance model, the board's interaction is solely with the chief executive officer. So the CEO is responsible for gains and losses and fully accountable to the board of directors for success in pursuing the objectives that they set within the rules that they set. Now, the Carver governance model has a lot of positives to it, but if I tell you that one element of it, there's a tremendous agency risk in this, because if their information is only coming from the CEO, it's filtered by the CEO, it's given to them through the lens the CEO has, and it's got that particular risk, which we can address with this network governance overlay. So to illustrate, ooh, these didn't work well at all. All right. In the nested policy model, Carver describes these as being bowls within bowls. So this first bowl is the big bowl. That's the bowl that says, here's what the board says you can do. Here are your risk limits from the board. Here are the things we're trying to achieve, defined by the board. Hand it off to the CEO, who then refines them a little bit more. It's a slightly smaller bowl, who then hands it off to the people in the C-suite and the business line leaders, who then have a smaller bowl given to the middle management, and ultimately the people who are out making loans, selling the products, designing the products. They've got the smallest bowl, but there are thousands of them or hundreds of them around the company. Each of them is nested within the limits put at the higher level. And so they're not going to go wildly outside of what the board wants. And in this particular model, the losses or the potential surprises that they could have on a negative side are also substantially smaller because they're limited by the next level up. So this is sort of a handoff of risk limits, for example, as you go through this nesting. So the accountabilities are distributed, and then what's very important is that the communication lines are very sharp. Okay, between different bowls. There's not a lot of, the information doesn't have to filter from these guys all the way up to these guys. So we don't have that information loss problem. Again, the stakeholder committee, in terms of independent validation, is a group of people who meet directly with the board of directors to tell them what they think is happening at the company. liquidity providers, creditors, retirees, people who care about how long a company is going to be around. This board chief risk officer is somebody that the board hires. It's not the chief risk officer within the company. At the beginning, I said I think we focus too much on loss and risk management, too much on controls. One of the things about the creation of the chief risk officer's role is we've also been emphasizing that this chief risk officer should be independent, should be someone who can tell the board and tell other people when something's being done that might be too risky or might create a problem. Well, if that's the role that you've got, there's never going to be full trust in that person to engage them in the business decision-making process of the company. So I would argue that the chief risk officer within a company should not have that role in any greater way than any other employee in the company. They understand a different part of the company than some employees do, so if they see something, every employee should escalate something they think is wrong. But if that's their chief responsibility, they may never be brought into conversations that potentially will impact the value of the company. And that specific knowledge that risk managers have of how to value risk, how to value uncertainty, may not be fully utilized, may not be fully incorporated into product pricing, into product development. So if you have someone on the outside who can come in and validate what the risk management function is doing, much like an external audit company validates the processes and controls in the internal audit function, you can achieve the same thing in terms of getting that independent validation up to the board of directors. And again, this is also a very short matrix communication line, so the board doesn't suffer from the loss of information as it comes back up to it. This just didn't come across well. I'm not a professional consultant. Otherwise, this would be a much nicer looking chart. But the idea here is that on the outside, in terms of validation that the board has, they've got this board chief risk officer and the stakeholder committee giving them direct feedback. The chief executive officer is getting direct and unbiased feedback from the internal audit function. And inside here is how the company is working in support of the people who are taking risks. So it's risk education and pricing. It's not risk management that's happening in our risk function. It's helping the people who originate the risk to understand how to use that scarce resource like risk capital, like brand, and how to respond to events as they occur. That's the education function, and the pricing is the pricing of the capital. These communication lines are also very short. So this model is distributed in that this is where the risk is being originated and managed with the support of this group. It's got the independent checks back to the board and also to the CEO, and it's got the direct accountability of the CEO to the board. So the board is engaged in policy, setting rules, objectives, and evaluating the CEO, like the Carver model, but with some of the checks on it so that we can avoid some of the communication problems and some of the agency risks that we've got. Ultimately, we're trying to encourage this distribution of risk taking. We want to nest policies so that each level, the risk taking is slightly less than it would be at the higher level. Make sure that we've got an input into each of these nested groups from an outside party so that you break groupthink. You make sure that there is independent information that's not filtered in the same way coming to them. And then externally, being open and transparent so that those who are providing capital to the company, the investors in the company, have confidence that what they see is what they're going to get and that those surprise losses aren't going to be there, that this notion of loss avoidance isn't influencing the discounting that they're applying to this particular company. And ultimately what you wind up doing then is increasing the value of the company, if that's the way in which companies are being valued. Going back, predating the study that Gomperzici and Metrick did, McKinsey back in 2000, surveyed institutional investors around the world, or 22 countries around the world, and they said they would pay, on average, an 18% premium for companies that were well-governed. Those numbers start to look like some of these numbers that we saw in the research after that, 16-17% premium. So it looks to us like there's some more validation of the notion that governance is something people are willing to pay for. Again, risk management, I think, operates within the governance framework. Enterprise risk management creates value, and governance creates value. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for letting me go on and on. Joe.
I've looked more at just financial institutions, and now there are a lot of discussions on comp issues, on board governance, as it relates to just the banking industry or the finance industry.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I can't say there's anything special that I've done to look at that industry and say, are there different things being done within finance that they're not doing in, say, chemical industry. But I think what you hit on in terms of compensation issues is something that's universally true. If there's not an alignment of compensation with risk-taking, so you're rewarding short-termism or you're rewarding big bets, you're going to get the result. It just happens to be that it was concentrated in financial services in these last couple of years. There was another study done that I didn't cite here that looked at CEO compensation and whether it was options-based, heavily options-based. I think the title of the paper was called Swinging for the Fences, and it might have come out of, I don't know if it was out of Wharton, it might have been out of the University of Pittsburgh. In any case, CEOs that had a high percentage of their compensation being option-based took riskier bets, no surprise, had worse returns, no surprise, than those who didn't, because they were incented to take big bets. I mean, people will do what you incent them to do. So I think it's really important to bring up that compensation is one of these elements that has to go into the governance framework, but that's also part of the nesting of the policies. You know, compensation committee at the board is where that starts. Any other questions?
You were not very clear on that. So independence of management.
Yeah.
So how are you putting a board PRO, so a board member that specializes in risk?
That's a good question. So the SEC now is trying to put new rules in place, or suggesting that there'll be some new rules put in place that ask companies, publicly owned companies, to describe the expertise in regards to risk management on the board and why they don't have it or what they do have and who has it. I'm one who, and I think maybe I had this question last time I was here, I'm one who doesn't believe that a board can have that kind of expertise and expect to have that kind of expertise across the 5,000 or 6,000 publicly traded companies in the U.S., whatever the number is, maybe it's even 7,000 or 8,000 companies, there just isn't that much talent out there. So if they, though, validate that the company has the resources to manage its risks well, that it's got an infrastructure in place to understand the risks that it's taking, I think it can fall back on that prudent judgment rule, that prudent business decision rule. But when the SEC starts saying that, no, you have to have that expertise on the board, I think that's kind of the overreaction that Sarbanes-Oxley is an example of some of the overreactions that took place post-Enron. This external party is not intended to manage the risks of the company, but the idea is that the risk committee or audit committee, wherever it is that risk management is being observed or the sufficiency of the resources being observed at the board level, can have someone who's going in and testing for various elements of risk management in the company and saying to them, we have a concern here, we have a concern here, or everything looks like it's done at a best practice. And then the board can honestly say, we brought in expertise that we didn't have, and it told us this, and we relied on that.
You were saying earlier that independent risk management, if you have really independent risk managers, then
within the company,
they won't be included in the decision making.
I don't think you can have a truly independent risk manager either way. So if the risk manager is independent, they might not be brought into the business decisions, but they will probably be brought in some of them. And just like there's no such thing really as an independent director, the performance of the company reflects on the risk manager. Ask anybody who's been at one of these companies that went away. You and I have a friend who worked for one of the companies that was severely damaged in the subprime crisis, who had 20 years of very successful career and was doing all the right things and raising all the right issues, but can't get away from the fact that he was there at a place that had problems. And he's not alone, there are lots of people that are like that. So they're never really independent of it. So the filter that they bring in reporting stuff is their own filter. It's not something that's unbiased. Yeah?
Can you go back to your slide 28 on the network governance? Have any of those
Not that I know of, no. I don't think so. This is pretty new. I mean, where's Alex? I mean, raise your hand. Raise your hand, Alex. Alex Todd and I had an interesting conversation yesterday. We got connected because he had read some of Shan Turnbull's work and must have seen my name somewhere as I was quoting Shan's work. Shan only cites a couple of different places where this is happening. I think Visa International is one of the ones that he thinks has this kind of stakeholder control that's there. But I haven't seen any of the metric companies try to measure this thing, and I don't know that many companies that are doing it. There is there was a gentleman I talked to at a large asset manager on the East Coast, and I can't say the name of it, but they have engaged someone as a head of complexity in their company. And so part of what they're trying to do is map all the networks within their company to understand how information flows, not just digitally, not just the IT networks, but communication networks within the company. And he seemed pretty excited. He had some very cool charts on his desk anyway. I don't know if that means anybody's using them, but they're a pretty cool charts.
Any final questions for David? No? Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for coming.